Good morning. You may be seated. Justice Pfeiffer is on his way, and he'll be joining us at some point. The first case is 07140, Andrea Barnes, Executrix versus University Hospitals of Cleveland. Mr. Roper.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
About 18 months ago, this court in Russo versus McDonald made 2 points crystal clear regarding Ohio's private judge statute 270110. One, it is the statute itself that confers subject matter jurisdiction on private judges to hear cases. And two, that statute and this court's rules do not permit private judges to impanel a jury. That case was obviously decided after our case went to trial, and that's exactly what happened in this case. We retained Judge Glickman to preside over a jury trial, and we believe that because of Russo, the actions of Judge Glickman in impaneling a jury trial were void as a matter of law for 3 reasons. One, no subject matter jurisdiction was conferred upon him to do that. Two, subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived. And three, lack of subject matter jurisdiction renders a verdict void.
Mr. Roper, the statute is, as you know, 2701, let's find it here. The statute 2701.10 does not require that the judge be an elected judge to be voluntarily retired. Our rule does in defining voluntarily retired judge. Can the rule supersede? The statute would seem to give jurisdiction to a judge who has not been elected but who's voluntarily retired. He or she's been appointed as a judge was here and then retires without an election. Statute would seem to give that judge the authority to act as a voluntarily retired judge or as a private judge. Can our rule of the court supersede for jurisdiction purposes the statute?
We think it can, Your Honor, and actually that was addressed in the Russo decision, we believe. This court in Russo said, and I believe it was at paragraph 20 or 47, that 270110 must be construed together in pari materia, I think is the phrase the court used, with Rule 6 of the Rules for the Government of the Judiciary. And when you read those two sections together, there are two things that must occur before to be a voluntarily retired judge in Ohio. One is you must have been elected, and then you couldn't have lost your last election for new or continued service to that position. And the other is you must be registered with the clerk of the county in which you wish to receive appointments as a private judge. We know in this case, obviously, that Judge Glickman was not elected. We know that now. We know now that he wasn't registered in Cuyahoga County. We believe that because of that, the statute did not confer jurisdiction on him to preside over the case, in addition, obviously, to presiding over a jury trial.
You didn't know that when you tried the case?
We did not.
You didn't know that he had been appointed twice by Governor Taft?
No, sir.
And you didn't waive it?
No, sir.
Did you sign a waiver?
No, sir.
Did, following up on the Chief's question, you have a statute that on its face appears to confer jurisdiction because it does not have the limitation. You have a rule that this court promulgated that does seem to require the election of the judge. Why is one not void? Therefore, if you were not at all a judge, you could not serve, and one voidable, which would require you to object to preserve?
We believe, like a lot of examples, you have to read rules in conjunction with statutes, rules of civil procedure in conjunction with certain requirements in the revised code, rules of evidence. This court obviously has the power and did, in fact, set forth the rules for the government of the judiciary. And it specifically referenced RC 270110. And for the most part, it laid out again the same requirements. But it did define in no uncertain terms what a voluntarily retired judge meant. And I think it did that because it's important when you look at this court's rules in the legislature that the court wanted and the legislature wanted previously elected judges to hold this position. This is a very powerful position to be a private judge. And if it were otherwise, the governor, for example, could simply appoint someone to be a judge. That person could retire the next week and then be a private judge for life without ever having been elected. And so I think what the court and the legislature were looking for here is if you are going to be a private judge, you have to have been elected once.
But the legislature didn't say that.
Well, this court said that, I'm sorry, in the rules.
Said the legislature set the power, spoke in those terms, but legislature didn't. The legislature apparently thought it was okay if an assigned judge or an appointed judge who then retired is okay if that judge was a private judge under the statute. Wouldn't that be the conclusion we'd make from reading the statute?
Well, I think that the statute, when it says voluntarily retired, there is some interpretation as to what that means.
It means the person hasn't reached 70 or that age at which point you can't serve anymore.
Correct. But again, I think another example of in this court's rules, when it further defines voluntarily retired, for example, on who and who we don't want to be a private judge, if, for example, a judge has some sort of disciplinary charges pending against them, and they voluntarily retire because of that without facing those charges, this court says in its rules that person is not qualified to be a private judge. And I would submit that makes sense because we don't want to have somebody who's retired but potentially has some disciplinary charges against them. And so what we're looking for in private judges is someone who's been elected. They don't have any of those charges filed against them, and we're certainly not suggesting that with respect to Judge Glickman, obviously. And they can't have lost their last election. And the reason is because I think when the electorate has spoken, we defer to them. And when the electorate says to somebody they vote a judge out of office, they've essentially said, thank you very much, but we don't want you to be our judge anymore. And so for that reason, that makes sense as to why that person can no longer be a private judge in Ohio, because that person has incredible authority. If it were otherwise and the parties could somehow waive that, at least submit you can't waive subject matter jurisdiction.
Counsel, could you explain how Judge Glickman was selected to handle this particular trial? You did have some input into his selection, I take it.
Yes, both sides under the private judge statute have to agree to the private judge, and both sides in this case agreed to retain Judge Glickman to be their private judge. He held himself at that point to be a qualified private judge in Ohio.
Although you could have looked at the record to see if he was ever been elected. That issue could have been discovered by you before selecting him as the judge, correct?
Your Honor, what we would have done had we looked at that, and to be perfectly frank, we did not. We would have, like any attorney, if you want to find out if they're licensed to practice in Ohio or a private judge, I think the first step would be to contact the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court at that time was required and does, in fact, maintain a list of private judges. Judge Glickman was obviously on that list at the time. That's where the inquiry would have stopped. Just like if I would have looked to see if my opposing counsel was licensed to practice in Ohio, I would have contacted this court. He's licensed. I think the inquiry would have stopped at that point. I wouldn't have done, geez, let's make sure he went to law school. Let's make sure he's current on his CLE.
So, counsel, you're saying that if Judge Glickman was on the list of, promulgated by the Supreme Court at the time this trial took place as an approved private judge registered with the Supreme Court, and there was no inquiry into how he left the bench status-wise, you still would not be able to waive. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
So you're saying no matter whether you had good faith or dilatory, due diligence or whatever, that doesn't matter. the authority, the jurisdiction, was not vested in this particular individual by virtue of his service.
Exactly. The only way we believe that a private judge can acquire jurisdiction is through the statute. And so you have to, and that's exactly what the court said in Russo. You have to look at the statute, and the statute is what confers subject matter jurisdiction on the judge to hear the case. And of course, in Russo, the court said the statute does not confer that for a judge to impanel a jury and preside over a jury trial. We had that in this case, obviously, and again, we believe for that reason alone, the jury's result is void as a matter of law. The issue wasn't before you on the qualifications in Russo, obviously. That is what this case is about. The same statute, we believe, again, confers jurisdiction on the judge. The judge is the court. Confers jurisdiction on the judge to oversee the case.
In the case of In re JJ, we address procedural irregularities occurring in the transfer of a case to a judge. What is your response to the argument that this is a procedural irregularity that the parties overlooked?
We would submit that this is distinguishable from In re JJ for a couple of reasons. First of all, the judge that ended up presiding over that case was a qualified judge. He did have subject matter jurisdiction to sit and oversee that case. The issue in In re JJ was the case was transferred to him by a magistrate rather than by the administrative judge.
Yes.
And this court said that was an error in the transfer that made the action void but not voidable. This is different, we believe, because it's a 270110 case. And in the only way a private judge can acquire jurisdiction is through the statute. The lawyers can't confer it by agreement. In fact, the assigned judge has no say, actually, in that. When the parties agree to a private judge, it goes to a private
judge.
Well,
counsel, if it's only the statute that confers it, can this court then take it away by a rule that seems to be in conflict with the statute?
No, I don't believe this court could overrule the statute, but this court can certainly explain what the term voluntarily retired judge means. And that's why I think it was important in Russo when the court said...
But as the chief pointed out, the statute doesn't say anything about being elected.
You're correct, Your Honor. The statute does not precisely...
So under the statute, he had jurisdiction.
I don't believe he did have jurisdiction under the statute because the statute doesn't precisely define what a voluntarily retired judge is. And this court did it in no uncertain terms, obviously, in its rules, which have been in place for many years. And we believe the policy reasons behind this are if parties, first of all, parties can never waive subject matter jurisdiction. There was certainly no knowing waiver here. There was no disclosure at any point by Judge Glickman that he wasn't elected. He wasn't either registered with the Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas. So, for example, he would say, just so you folks know, I'm not registered. Is that okay with you? You agree to waive that? There was no discussion
like that.
Well,
what the statute requires also.
That would be required for a waiver, Your Honor, but there was no discussion about that. There was no knowing waiver. And we believe policy-wise, if or otherwise, if this court upholds in any way his actions in this case, that would allow the parties to confer jurisdiction now on someone. That would allow parties to waive subject matter jurisdiction. And that would empower parties to greatly expand the scope of judicial authority. I've got about a minute and a half left, and I reserve two for rebuttal, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Roper. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Paul Flowers. I represent Robert Barnes, who's the administrator of the estate of Natalie Barnes, I'm joined here with Craig Bashine and Michael Becker, who are my co-counsel. The opposing counsel's argument was devoted entirely to subject matter jurisdiction. I'd like to remind the court that that was part of their fifth proposition of law, which this court declined to accept. The irony here is that their entire subject matter jurisdiction argument is outside the jurisdiction that was granted by this court. I do feel compelled, though, to address these arguments, particularly the factual representations with regard to what has been made that occurred below in response to Justice Pfeiffer's and Justice Lanzinger's questions. Mr. Roper wasn't there. Mr. Roper was hired as an attorney, we found out in the PGA proceedings, to monitor the trial and look for appeal issues. I'm not putting him down because that's a function I've been called on to perform from time to time myself. But the lawyers who were there, who were representing MedLink at the time, were two very capable Reminger and Reminger attorneys, Jim Malone and John Coyne. They practiced in Cleveland. They were fully aware of who Robert Glickman was. Jim Malone recommended Robert Glickman. It was his idea. He had used him in the past. He had tried cases to Robert Glickman as a private judge and was very pleased with how Robert Glickman handled himself. Mr. Bashine and Mr. Becker were also there. They also agreed that Mr. Glickman was suitably qualified, that he was the right man for the job. And best of all, he had the time as a private judge to handle the trial. The originally assigned judge, Judge Mannin, had other things she had to deal with. Trying a case to a judge who has 8 hours a day, 5 days a week to devote to the case is a real luxury in a medical malpractice action. And at least in Cuyahoga County, we were regularly trying malpractice cases and other complex civil cases to private judges like Judge Glickman, like Judge Peggy Foley Jones, and like others. When it was brought up, everyone there knew. Everyone knew that the Private Judge Act was untested. Everyone knew that the MetroHealth versus Satula case was going through the court, where Judge John Satula had refused to grant a referral to a private judge because he didn't believe that the statute allowed jury trials. Judge Nancy Margaret Russo agreed with this several months later in her case pursued through the 8th District. Everyone knew that. Everyone knew that it was untested. And because of that, there were discussions with the Reminger and Reminger attorneys. And a record, Mr. Malone says there was no signed waiver. It was on the record. But that's what he's not saying, that they put it on the record, that they were waiving appeal rights. I'm looking at page 146 to 147 of the transcript. This is before the first witness testifies. Mr. Becker, Mr. Bashine, it's my understanding on behalf of your client, you waive any appellate argument regarding my presiding over this case or my presiding over a case in front of a jury. Is that accurate? Mr. Bashine, yes. The court, Mr. McDonald, on behalf of your client, Mr. McDonald, correct. Mr. McDonald is representing University Hospital.
Counsel, would you address the conflict between, well, not conflict, but the discrepancy between the rule and the statute and whether one is void and one is voidable or whether they have to be read in pari materia, as counsel suggests?
Certainly, Your Honor. Let me just finish my quote so I'm not accused of reading only part of a quote. The final line is the court, Mr. Coyne, who represents MedLink, on behalf of your client, Mr. Coyne, yes. Knowing voluntary agreement to Private Judge Glickman, presiding over the jury trial, and waiver of appeal rights. There's a reason they don't mention that in their briefs. It's because it's fully enforceable under Ohio law. Judge, that does bring me then to the subject matter jurisdiction argument, which again, shouldn't be part of this appeal, but I will address your question. Judge O'Donnell pointed out, that was decided in the...
Excuse me a second. Why is it not part of the appeal? Because the proposition that we did accept, if I can get that...
Number three?
Is... it's the private judge...
One who's never been elected.
One who's never been elected. That
correct.
Seems to be a subject matter jurisdiction question, so I don't understand why it's not on a... That's not before us.
They put subject matter jurisdiction in their fifth propositional law. Three just dealt with, do you have to be elected to be a private judge?
Okay,
Five was, if you don't follow the statute, is it outside? And
it seems
for
to
whatever
be,
reason.
Okay, it seems to be entwined. If you're not elected, you don't have subject matter jurisdiction under the statute. Now, the rule is, the statute doesn't say that. That's why I want to explore that with you, because only the rule says that.
Correct.
And so what is the difference between the statute and the rule? How do they interplay, in your opinion?
The way it's set up, we have a statute that does not require a judge to be elected. Gubernatorial appointment is fine, and that's true under the Constitution. Both types of judges are fully empowered to decide cases in common pleas courts. It's the rule that causes the problem, because the rule defines voluntary retired judges in terms of elected. The General Assembly sets jurisdiction, and I'm the first to say, yes, 2701.10 establishes jurisdiction, but it's not subject matter jurisdiction.
So you would agree if somebody was a magistrate and was serving as a private judge, they would not have subject matter jurisdiction and that would be void?
You would have to have a gubernatorial appointment.
Okay, and so that no subject matter jurisdiction can't try the case?
They wouldn't have jurisdiction over that particular case.
Okay.
In re JJ instructs that you need to have a timely objection, before you can challenge that on appeal. That is crystal clear. Syllabus of that case, paragraph one, in a court that possesses subject matter jurisdiction, procedural irregularities in the transfer of a case to a visiting judge affect the court's jurisdiction over the particular case and render the judgment voidable, not void.
So your position would be that since they did, they waived under the rule that, and they did not object, that is not preserved. And the statute, since it does not mention electability, confers subject matter jurisdiction.
Right. Just to address both parts of that, they didn't object for months. I mean, we had our jury verdict in May of 05. You don't get your first objection to Judge Glickman until March of 06. And it's not in this case. They didn't object in this case. They objected through a writ petition filed in this court that was denied. It was dismissed, refiled, and denied. So these arguments have been here before. When they raised their arguments, they didn't raise in front of Judge Glickman, and that prevents us from submitting an affidavit or deposing Mr. Malone and Mr. Malone to establish that they knew full well this gentleman had been elected. These were publicized elections. There were matters of public record. So now they can stand here and say we didn't know because we don't have a record to show whether they did or didn't. If it had been raised, we could put on our case and we could show that that's nonsense.
Did the Russo case come up after this trial?
Yes.
How does the Russo decision on the jury issue affect subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, Russo doesn't deal with subject matter jurisdiction. There's some comments in there. But what Russo says is that you can't have a private judge handling a jury trial, and it's only because of the way the statute's worded. It's just because it's not in there. This court refused to read that language in there. So in this case, that is true. You know, we find out afterwards that you shouldn't have a jury trial in front of a private judge. But that's something that is a procedural irregularity. You need a timely objection, which, despite what they say, we didn't have here. Never objected to Judge Glickman. And that's just such deep-seated bedrock law.
So your position would be that the jury issue is also a voidable issue subject to objection to preserve?
Absolutely. There's a great case that you authored for an unanimous court, Pratts versus Hurley, that's got some terrific language on that. Paragraph 33 has got the remark, jurisdiction is a word of many, too many meanings. And that's certainly true here. They trot out jurisdiction like anything that goes wrong in the trial affects the jurisdiction of the whole proceeding. And that's not subject matter jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is the single question of whether or not the court has the authority to hear the class of cases in which this case belongs. In Pratts versus Hurley, we were dealing with the statute that sets up in death cases when a plea can be taken. The statute required three judges in the panel, and in Pratts versus Hurley, there's only one judge. And this court said, yes, they violated the statute, but that's a procedural irregularity. He didn't object at the time. It's waived. In fact, he was trying to attack it collaterally, and he certainly couldn't attack it collaterally. Now they cite Pratts versus Hurley five times in their reply brief, which is mystifying to me. And I think it's because this court said a direct appeal is the way to go. But this court certainly didn't overturn longstanding precedent that said that in order to have a direct appeal, you have to have a timely objection. And there is no timely objection here.
Mr. Flowers, I wonder if we could move on to the other proposition of law involving the punitive damages. And there is an argument that is made that because the main damages came through a wrongful death action, that those damages cannot be considered in determining what the ratio of compensatory to punitive damages is. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. I think your position would be that they should be part of the measurement, and just wonder what your strongest argument for that point is.
Absolutely. Let me just finish my final thought to Judge Lundberg-Stratton's question. This case is a wrongful death medical malpractice action. There is no dispute that common pleas courts have subject matter jurisdiction to hear medical malpractice wrongful death actions. That's the end of the subject matter debate. Pratts versus Hurley says once you establish jurisdiction, everything else that goes on deals with jurisdiction of that particular case and is merely voidable, not void. That's Pratts versus Hurley. That's binding here. Justice Kupp, to your question then on punitive damages, again, this 30-to-1 ratio, that is part of the second proposition of law that this court didn't take. Right. For whatever reasons, they spelled it out as a separate proposition of law. For whatever reasons, a majority of this court did not agree to hear that. That's still a dominant theme in their brief. The guideposts that are established in both BMW versus Gore and in Campbell versus State Farms are just that, guideposts. The court makes it very clear that no one is dispositive. A plaintiff doesn't have to satisfy all three in order to justify their punitive damage award. The ratio works well in cases like BMW and like State Farm, where we're talking about purely financial harm. BMW, it was scratches on cars that resulted in car damage. State Farm, it was a bad faith claim where the gentleman's claim wasn't paid for 18 months. No injuries were involved and certainly no deaths. And the ratios were staggering in those cases. It was 500-1 in BMW versus Gore and 145-1 in State Farm. Here they come up with 30-1 by ignoring the wrongful death damages. BMW versus Gore and State Farm both say we look at the harm caused and compare that to the damages. And the full harm here is not just the survivorship damages, but all the harm from the wrongful death that the General Assembly has determined is compensable. You got to look at it all. And that was the issue.
But the jury found $100,000 for on the non-wrongful death part of this case, did it not? Isn't that what we have to use to determine and the Court of Appeals didn't even go through the what it's supposed to do, it seems to me, expressly tell us or tell the parties that we reviewed the three principles from BMW, did it? I mean, you say, well, it's sort of, yeah, you can tell they did, but it seems to me it's so easy for a Court of Appeals to do what the U.S. Supreme Court said it should do, and here it did not.
Well, you know, the Court of Appeals has been criticized heavily in this proceeding, and keep in mind that they had to deal with 5 appeals, 16 assignments of error, and they still wrote a 27-page opinion.
Well, that doesn't matter. I mean, we're here on the assignment of error that relates to this very important issue, it seems to me. And, you know, Courts of Appeals get lots of assignments of error all the time, and that doesn't get them off the hook.
Well, we had both the trial judge and the Court of Appeals address the issue of punitive damages thoroughly. Judge Glickman certainly cited State Farm. Remember, in their merit brief, they say he refused to provide any analysis. We point out he issued a decision. The reply brief, they say, oh, the decision's indecipherable. It isn't. He points out what happened at trial. And the Court of Appeals does it even more thoroughly. The actual analysis of the constitutional issue is only a paragraph long, but they've got several pages of the facts. And those facts spell out that BMW versus Gore has been satisfied.
Well, counsel, somewhere, it may have been in the discussion of prejudgment interest, but somewhere, Judge Glickman walks you through, or walks anyone who's looking at what he was deciding, what was on the table here. And he makes particular reference to the fact that they knew ahead of time and that there was a second injury here. That is that the mother, faced with this overwhelming problem of having to decide to terminate the life of her daughter,
right,
ended up institutionalized. And he discusses that and discusses the fact that they knew that a jury could be very dangerous to approach on the issue of punitives. And isn't that what State Farm, what the court, Justice Kennedy is discussing in State Farm is, do you know,
right,
from the nature of what's on the table that you could get really hammered with punitives? And then he lays out a test, and I'm reading from their brief. The harm caused was physical as opposed to economic in deciding the reprehensibility of the conduct. That the tortious conduct involved an indifference or reckless disregard to the health and safety of others. So right there's a pretty substantial difference between, as you point out, Gore and State Farm.
Absolutely. You know, and we have a defense lawyer here who before the trial writes a letter predicting a $3 million verdict, which he says is unlikely to be reversed on appeal, and he predicts it to a penny months before. That's incredible. I mean, how anybody can stand here with a straight face and say this was a runaway verdict is beyond me. But to finish your question, you know, the biggest State Farm factor is not the ratio. In Reitman versus Consolidated Rail, the ratio wasn't important to this court because it was a death case. This court approved what would be 1,650-1 because the facts are so egregious and because there was a life taken. And that's the same thing here. We have a woman who's hired who is unqualified. She's a felon. She's put in charge of a patient who everyone knows needs special care, a red flag patient. They do it only because of the money. They do it over the warnings of the medical people at MedLink. She's put in charge. She leaves this woman. And then after all that happens, they find out immediately that she was disqualified, she had the felony, she didn't have the education. They knew she was a liar because she claimed she wasn't told she had to stay there when she was. And instead of firing her, they put her back on the job to care for more MRDD patients. I mean, that is pure, deliberate, calculated decisions to put profits over safety. And it's not anything we made up. That's the admissions of MedLink's management. You know, why anyone would want to try this case again is beyond me, because they got lucky. They certainly could have been hit with a far larger award than $3 million,
Counsel,
which would be perfectly appropriate.
Before you go down that path,
yes.
What would your position be if this court finds that there was no jurisdiction initially? Are you telling us that that is subject to waiver?
Yes, absolutely. It's the jurisdiction over a particular case.
According, if we find no jurisdiction based on 2710.10 as read in paramateria with the Supreme Court rule, you still say that that is a waivable, that that can be waived, and that the appellants waive that?
Absolutely. It is, INRI JJ spells that very clear, as does Pratt versus Hurley. Once you have subject matter jurisdiction conferred, the complaint is filed.
If we find no subject matter jurisdiction, that's my question to you. Not if we do find it, or if we find no subject matter jurisdiction based on the status of Judge Glickman, can that be waived?
If you find no subject matter jurisdiction, no. No, I can't say that.
Okay.
I'm not going to stand here and advocate to overrule years of precedence.
Okay.
But it is not subject matter jurisdiction. They're kind of cute. They say with Russo, this court said subject matter is conferred on the judge. Subject matter is conferred on courts, not judges. Court of Common Pleas had subject matter jurisdiction over this wrongful death.
Could a probate judge sit on a Court of Appeals without assignment of the Chief Justice?
If a probate judge sat on the Court of Appeals without assignment and no one objects, he at that point is a de facto judge. He has all the authority
so
of a jury judge.
Well, we're getting into de facto, but he or she would not have jurisdiction, would they, to sit on a Court of Appeals outside, totally outside their statutory jurisdiction? Would they have authority to jurisdiction?
As a de facto judge, the Huffman versus Huffman case out of the 10th
District. So a de facto judge is something that, what, supersedes having jurisdiction, having the legal authority to act as a judge in a certain capacity?
He has jurisdiction by his de facto status. No one's objected. They've allowed him to proceed. He has that status. Subject matter jurisdiction would be, does the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction to hear this final appealable order? That's subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, you're right. We get two issues. One is whether a case is filed in the correct court, and does the court have, and then the other is, does the judge have jurisdiction? They sometimes run together. They're a little
right. And if you go down this path of saying this is subject matter jurisdiction, the floodgates will be open, because every case Judge Glickman heard is going to be voidable. Or not voidable, I'm sorry, will be void. Everyone can go back, get those undone, and retry their cases. They make the argument, oh, you have to direct appeal that. No, no, no. They also say subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, can't be waived.
But if we dissociate ourselves from the qualifications of Judge Glickman, the statute seems to say, and our decision in Russo seems to say, regardless of his qualifications, even if he had been elected, there's no authority for him to conduct a jury proceeding.
Correct. It does say that. And that's, again, a procedural error that requires an objection. And here, not only have no objection, we've got an outright waiver of appeal rights, knowingly made by intelligent lawyers.
You think that's something that can be waived?
Absolutely.
All right, thank you.
All that can't be waived is subject matter jurisdiction, and that's why this court guards it so carefully. INRI JJ, Pratt versus Hurley, the court's been very clear that subject matter jurisdiction conferred at the outset. Everything else after that is jurisdiction over the particular case. It's all been waived. They have no right to appeal. That judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Roper, start with a minute and a half.
This case is different than Pratt's and INRI JJ for one essential reason. In both of those cases, the litigants ended up in front of a qualified judge. It was how they got there. was the error in the transfer. But at the end of the day, due process was served because they were before a judge in the court. This is different here. This, in some respects, is outside. The court and the judge is the same person, we would submit. Here, private parties are conferring jurisdiction on a judge through a statute, and so you have to look at the statute. This trial didn't even have to take place in the Court of Common Pleas in Cuyahoga County. It could have taken place in a conference room. So it's a little bit different. That's why it's critical that you look at the statute to see what powers are we giving this judge. Regarding opening the floodgates of litigation, it's been represented that every trial that Judge Glickman presided over as a private judge was a jury trial. If the floodgates are open, they've been opened because of the Russo decision, and we're not aware of anything coming back to this court on that. In reality here, what we have are three things. Judge Glickman clearly wasn't a voluntarily retired judge under this court's rules read in conjunction with the statute. He wasn't registered to receive those appointments in Cuyahoga County, and that's a statutory requirement that he didn't meet. And obviously, because of Russo, he couldn't impanel a jury. Any one of those three things voids jurisdiction. We simply agreed at the beginning to waive any argument regarding Judge Glickman sitting in place of the assigned judge. We didn't have the benefit of knowing about Russo then. We didn't have the benefit of knowing about Judge Glickman's qualifications. We thought he was qualified. This court thought he was qualified.
I want to go back to the waiver, which you denied when I asked you directly the first time. Did you not also waive the jury question?
We waived any argument about substituting Judge Glickman in for the assigned judge. But we didn't waive all kinds of other things like, you know, errors that could be made during trial, that sort of thing. And regarding notice and the writ of prohibition that was mentioned, this was discovered while Judge Glickman was deciding prejudgment interest. We couldn't go to him at that point with our position, he didn't have jurisdiction. We came to this court to prohibit him from ruling against us on prejudgment interest, a writ of prohibition to stop him from doing that. A couple of days
when,
after
when you say this was discovered, what you really mean is somebody read our rule at some point in time. Everybody knew everything else about Judge Glickman. They just hadn't looked at this rule, which conflicts with the statute.
No, actually what happened, Your Honor, is Judge Glickman and counsel for the appellee, when Lexington Insurance wanted to intervene in this case, they wanted a very specific waiver at the prejudgment interest hearing. Unbeknownst to us, Russo was pending at that time. We didn't have any idea about that. The counsel for appellee was counsel for the underlying litigants in the Russo case. So they knew in the fall of 2005 that this was coming.
I have trouble with pronouns. When you use the term we, do you include every counsel representing the defendants in this case, or are you, is the we just your law firm or you?
The we is MedLink.
And every counsel for MedLink?
Your Honor, I honestly don't know what every other.
Well, then please don't use the word we when you.
I apologize. But I apologize, Your Honor, but the point I was trying to make was when this all came about during the prejudgment interest hearing, when this very specific waiver was being discussed about Lexington waiving all these arguments on Judge Glickman's qualifications, on him presiding over a jury, very specifically, that just struck us as odd. Clearly, counsel for the other side knew about Russo because they were the litigants in the underlying case. That's what caused us to say, this just seems different to us. Why is Lexington being asked to do this? And that's when, and we were puzzled. We looked at this court's listing for private judges and saw him on the list. But something didn't seem right. And that's when we found out he wasn't elected. And that's when we brought this up to try to get him to not rule on their motion for prejudgment interest, the writ of prohibition, stop him from doing that. 2 days after he received service of that, he ruled against us on prejudgment interest. There was nothing at that point, for us to ask this court to stop. He had made his ruling. We chose then, of course, to bring this up in the Court of Appeals. So procedurally, that's how we got here.
Thank you, Mr. Roper. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.